comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to the Kevin Smith Show, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this gorgeous place we call Earth. Thank you for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. I know there are a million things you could be doing, but you've chosen to be here, and I am delighted you have. It is talk radio like nowhere else on Earth. It's the show where you matter. Let me urge you, if you haven't subscribed to our free weekly newsletter, be sure you do. Just go over to my website, click where it says K-Files, and subscribe. You can unsubscribe anytime you want to, and it's absolutely free, so there's no genius in not doing it. Also, let me urge you, if you haven't joined our members area, do it. Why not? What are you waiting for? It's 23 cents a day, and it's a tremendous value. You got a lot of stuff in there. Not the least of which is you get to watch the shows each night, and this is one show I think you would really like to be watching. All of them this week are going to be that sort of show. Now, a couple of weeks ago, I did a show that was focused on the mysteries of Lake Vostok. Lake Vostok is a large liquid water lake lying under 2.25 miles of ice on the continent of Antarctica. That show generated more email than any show in a long time. Now, my guest tonight will be Dr. Brooks Agnew. He is an expert in nuclear chemistry, an explorer, an engineer, an inventor, a best-selling author, a radio host, and a few other things. In a private conversation with Dr. Agnew, I talked with him in some detail about Lake Vostok, and he became very, very interested in it and has done some further research into this mystery at Lake Vostok. And we have had some subsequent conversations about Lake Vostok and decided that it's time to dive deeper into Vostok. And so tonight, Dr. Brooks Agnew will join me on the other side of the upcoming break, and we're going to be talking about this mystery, this anomaly at Lake Vostok. Now, if you didn't hear that previous show, let me just say this is not new news. I have been broadcasting shows about this mystery at Lake Vostok since the year 2000. This is not new news, but as science has advanced and as a few more little leaks have come out, it has become even more mysterious than it was in 2000. We know a bit more than we knew then, and I can't say that we have enough to say we can solve the puzzle. But we're getting, I think, more and more information, little bits of it, but we put them into place, and over time, the puzzle is beginning to be filled out. On the other side of this break, Dr. Brooks Agnew, and we dive deeper into Vostok.
Come on.
And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. Dr. Brooks Agnew is my guest this evening. And as I said in the top of the show, he and I have done some pretty in-depth discussions about this mystery at Lake Vostok, and he has agreed to bring his expertise to the subject and join us tonight for a discussion diving deeper into Vostok. So, Dr. Brooks Agnew, welcome back to the show. We're delighted to have you back.
Thank you, Kevin. This is a very fascinating subject.
When you and I talked about this last week, first, let me say, let me preface this by saying you are truly one of the top scientists in this country. And when we talked about this last week, it was something that you, when we first talked, something that you were not aware of, but you became very, very interested in it very quickly, and you've done quite a bit of research into it. Now, today, I have talked with a number of other top scientists and talked with them about Lake Vostok, and none of them had ever heard of this magnetic anomaly at Lake Vostok. Only one had heard that they something about Vostok and the Russians were going to drill down into the cavity where the liquid water is. But the point is, none of them had heard about all of this, and yet I've been doing shows on this since 2000. And it would seem that my listeners are better informed than many of the top scientists in this country. Why do you think that is?
Well, that doesn't surprise me at all, because in order to become a top scientist in this country, first of all, you have to be affiliated with something, some university, some major company that sponsors your activities, because most scientists pick crumbs with the sparrows. They don't have money of their own. They have to rely on grants and support from major corporations, and the ones that are in R&D usually study in a very, very narrow portion of the science. Only those that use their scientific expertise to reach outside and explore the mysteries of the Earth would be exposed to something like Vostok. Now, I heard about Vostok, I don't know, probably back early 2000, maybe 2002, 2003, and I thought that they had actually drilled into the thing way back then, but I understand that they got stopped for like 9 years due to environmental concerns and the fact that they're drilling with hydrocarbons in the hole, which means they drill with virtually kerosene in the hole. And the concern rose that when they punched through into the lake, that this was a very pristine environment, and they were about to dump about 60,000 pounds of kerosene into a pristine environment. So the environmentalists stopped them from doing it. Couple that with the fact that the last 8 or 9 years, the Antarctic has had a horrible winters and very, very short summers. The summer's over February 6th down there, just to give you an idea, and then it gets to about 90 below zero. So they've only been able to drill for a few weeks a year, and then the conditions have been deplorable, and the funding hasn't been there to really continue. But 9 days ago, just 9 days ago on Fox News, of all places, Dr. Vispu, who's one of the scientists up in Montana that happens to be serving on that project, was interviewed, and he said they're about to break through into that, and they may do it this week. So that kind of brings it up into current events again.
Well, you know, the official story is, as we discussed, that they have not yet broken through into this airspace above the lake. And so folks can picture this. Imagine you're standing on the surface out there, 2 1/4 miles beneath your feet. There's nothing but ice. But 2 1/4 miles down, the ice ends and there's an airspace. That airspace is over a liquid water lake. The liquid water lake is 160 miles long. It's about 2,000 feet deep at one point. So if you were sitting in a boat on that lake, you would have 2.25 miles of ice above you, and you would have 2,000 feet of water beneath you. This is massive. But here's the question. The official story is they had not broken through. They had not gotten into that cavity. And yet the articles that are being published tell us that the water temperature is 27 degrees Fahrenheit. The articles that are being published are telling us that the atmosphere in that cavity above the liquid water is supersaturated with oxygen. How do they know that if they haven't broken through?
Well, that's exactly right. You know, one of my areas of expertise is spectroscopy. And in order to spectrographically analyze the molecular content of the atmosphere in that space, they would have had to have taken headspace samples. That means somewhere along the line, they've pierced this with some kind of probe, and they've taken a headspace sample. That's the only way that they could tell what that headspace is. It could be methane, for all we know, unless you actually pierce that headspace and take a sample. So you're exactly right. To publish that it is a supersaturated oxygen content headspace without knowing, without sampling it, is virtually impossible.
Well, you know, you've heard me say this, Doctor. You have personally heard me say, these people need to get better script writers.
Well, I've heard that the temperature of the water was 49 degrees, and then there was an argument over whether it was Fahrenheit or Celsius.
Well, of course, if it was Celsius, that would be about 130 degrees Fahrenheit. Maybe 140 degrees Fahrenheit, if it was, what'd you say, 49 degrees?
49 degrees.
Because 40 degrees is 105 Fahrenheit. But the latest articles out there say that it's 27 degrees. And they say that it's able to remain liquid only because of two things. The mechanism that they're saying causes it to remain liquid is geothermal vents in the floor of the lake, and so you've got steam, heat coming up into the lake, and then because of the 2.25 miles of ice above it, there's so much pressure in that cavity that it's the pressure causing the freezing point of water, the freezing temperature of water, to drop so that it can remain liquid at 27 degrees.
Yeah, if in fact it is fresh water, that's exactly right. You would need more pressure. Of course, you can't pressurize water. So, you know, to lower the freezing temperature that much, you'd need some kind of electrolyte in water. There's also more evidence out there that what led them to this lake in the first place was seismic data that they had taken by setting off charges and also by satellite imagery using long-wave radiation, radio waves. But what switched the purview of this whole project from an environmental exploration into perhaps what might be paleoarchaeology to the National Security Administration is that there was a strong radioactive signal coming from one end of this lake. And that brought, and it was not an old radioactive signal. It was relatively new. It just showed up in the very recent past, like in the last couple of years, I think. And that got leaders' attention and switched the purview of this project over to a national security concern.
All right, for those who are watching our TV channel, I'm going to show a picture. I'll describe it now. for our radio audience. And this, what we're looking at, is a satellite picture of Lake Vostok. And Lake Vostok is the smooth sort of almost V-shape area in this ice cover. Now, I do want to point out that when I did the previous show, I showed a square, a rectangle, for the possible location of this magnetic anomaly, and I showed it at the other end of the lake from what I'm showing now. I showed it on the left side of the picture because they said it's on the north end of the lake. I didn't take into account that when you're standing at the South Pole, every direction you look is north. So this left side of the lake, this left wing of the lake, is pointed towards the South Pole. That means the north end of the lake is that other side, the right side. Now, in the articles that I've read about this, I've read two possible locations for this magnetic anomaly. And I've marked both of those locations on the picture. One of them extends out into the lake, and the other one is pretty much on the, it would be the northeast shore of the lake. And interestingly, I looked up the MRI graph readings that were produced. I cannot remember the man's name now, that the researcher that made the statements about it. But he put those on the internet. And this magnetic anomaly shows up in the position of this second rectangle that I have, which is running, if the top of the picture were north, which it's not, but if the top of the picture were north, this one is running due north and south on the extreme right of the picture. And what we can see, I've just got a little red rectangle outline there, and what we can see is basically a rectangular area that is disturbed. And they tell us that this magnetic anomaly is 65 miles by 46 miles. That's a rectangle. It's not a perfect square. It could be a rectangle. It could be a cylinder shape. But anyway, that's the likely location of this anomaly based on the descriptions that we have. You found out something about this magnetic anomaly that you shared with me on the telephone. Why don't you share that with the audience?
Well, one of the things that they published, and this was actually published in an Antarctic news article of a British newspaper that I ran across, kind of hard to find, that this anomaly, they're calling it a mass con. This is a reflective signal when they did, as you said, magnetic resonance imagery by flying over the area, looking for anomalies in the ice, and what reflected back to them literally just pegged their meters. What they've determined from this is that this signal is coming from what appears to be a large circular metal object. One article, they actually called it a disc. Now, when we say large, we say it's probably about the size of Los Angeles underneath the ice at one end of that lake. Now, some speculate that it could be an ancient power station, and by ancient I mean a couple hundred thousand years, and that now the shielding around it is breaking down and some of the radiation is leaking out. Now, you know that my degree is in nuclear chemistry, so when somebody says the word radiation, my ears perk up, and I want to know what the species of the decay is. Where on the nuclide chart does it fit? Because we can tell exactly what reactor a radiation source comes from based on its radioactive signature. It's just like a fingerprint. The molecular weight is virtually impossible to duplicate in any two reactors. It's idiosyncratic to the neutron activation of that particular sample. If we could determine that species of that radiation, we could determine not only how old it is, but whether it's terrestrial or extraterrestrial.
Now, how could you determine if it's extraterrestrial?
Well, because we know the signature of every single reactor on this planet. We catalog it. That way, if a source shows up somewhere like Boston or Florida that doesn't belong there, we know exactly where it came from. We know what warhead it came from. We know what reactor it came from. We know what country it came from. Every single reactor on the planet is known. If it's an unknown signature, then it's not from this world.
All right, now, well, I was going to get into something, but I'm not going to get into that right at this moment because I see we're only about a minute and a half away from break, and we wouldn't have time to really get into it. But let me tell you this. When you told me what you've just told the audience, that there are some folks speculating that this, or they've published that this is a large, very large metallic disc shape, I went looking for as much information about that as I could find. And I have to tell you, I didn't find much. But I did find one very interesting photograph. And this interesting photograph apparently was originally came from the A&E Network, you know, the Arts and Entertainment Network. And apparently what they did was a documentary on this. And this appears to be a still shot from that. But what it shows is pretty astounding, and it's something I want us to take a look at. It. We're going to compare it to a known site out on the surface that's in Russia, and it's pretty astounding stuff. But we're going to have to step away for a break for just 2 or 3 minutes, and when we come back from this break, we'll get into that. My guest this evening is Dr. Brooks Agnew. And we are talking about Lake Vostok, and hopefully not covering the same territory as I covered a couple of weeks ago. We'll be back right after this. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Dr. Brooks Agnew, and we are talking about Lake Vostok. Dr. Agnew, I don't know if you've been able to bring that screen up yet, but if you have, good. If not, then I will. You'll just have to rely on my descriptions of it.
Okay.
All right. Here's what we're going to look at. Now, folks, I went looking for any pictures of this area where the magnetic anomaly is supposed to be. I cannot verify that what you're about to see is in fact a close-up of the area. Yet this apparently appeared on A&E Network in some sort of documentary that they did. What we are looking at, it's actually one photograph. The one on the left is as it appears on the internet, and apparently as it appeared on A&E in their documentary. What I've done is we have a copy of it on the right, but I've laid it over on its side so that we don't get the sense that we're hanging up in space looking down at it. And what we see is an area that's of ice that's very disturbed, very broken up. But right in the center of that area, there are concentric circles. There are four entrances into the center circle from the outer circle. By entrances, I'm talking about pathways, if you will, roadways. There are four, one at the north, south, east, and west. Now, what's interesting about that is that fits the description that Plato provided for Atlantis.
Ah, that's right.
But it's also interesting because of the fact that there is a place out here on the surface, not in Antarctica, where there is something just like that. It's in Russia at a place called Arkhangelsk. Now, this place in Russia, let me get the report. This was reported on in Pravda. And it is said to be the strongest anomaly zone in Russia. And what we're looking at is the one in Antarctica and on the left, and then the one in Russia on the right. And the one on the right is black and white. And what they've done is a 3D reconstruction of what that circle would look like in Russia, and have overlaid the 3D reconstruction on top of the actual ruins. And so we can see that this thing looks just like the thing in Antarctica. Now, for folks that are watching on our TV channel, if you will notice, the one in Russia, it's concentric circles, four entrances, and the one at the bottom of the picture, the entrance at the bottom, is kind of a V shape, and this looks very much like those notch-backed UFOs that you see in some of the NASA films, some of the NASA videos, those notch-backed UFOs. That's what it looks like. I'm not saying this is a UFO. It definitely is not, but it has that appearance. Now, if you look at the one on the left, the one that's from Antarctica, you will see that it has also a V-shaped notched entrance. It's located at a different spot in this picture simply because of the way I have the picture oriented. It would be located, it's the entrance on the right side of the circles. So they look actually identical. Now, Arkhangelsk in Russia was a fortified settlement in the Bronze Age. Had four entrances. It's obvious that it was built according to some previously designed plan. In other words, it wasn't just haphazard. It had a high level of precision. All circumferences have one center where all the radial feeders meet together. And this circular structure is star-oriented. And the design itself looks like a model of the universe. And then when we look at the one in Antarctica, that's supposed to be in that area of magnetic anomaly, it looks, I would say, identical. Now, Dr. Agnew, I don't know, have you been able to bring that up on your screen?
No, I haven't. Only thing that shows up is to watch on mobile device. Click here.
Yeah, okay. All right, so that's what we're looking at. They look, I would say, identical, and they both of them match the description that Plato gives for the capital city on the continent of Atlantis. Or on the, it was a continent. It was a big island like Australia is today. And you've seen those pictures of the concentric circles as people would enter the harbor coming into Atlantis. You've seen that, right, Doctor? That's
sure,
what this
yeah.
looks like. Now, the interesting thing about that is if we look at the one on the left that's supposed to be from the magnetic anomaly area in Antarctica at Lake Vostok. Just keep that picture in your mind, folks. And we'll go back to this Lake Vostok satellite photograph. This Lake Vostok satellite photograph shows an area very disturbed and very blurred over on the northeast side of Lake Vostok. Somewhere there, and I think it's probably near the top of that disturbed area, because it kind of, it's a blurry, fuzzy looking thing, but it kind of looks circular. I think that's where it's at. All right, so what do you think, Dr. Agnew? You think this is a sort of man-made facility? Not man-made, but at least manufactured facility?
Well, I don't think it's natural. I think whatever is down there is not natural. Now, to say, is it man-made or not, one would have to really put a couple more grains of sand in the balance for the argument that there have been other advanced civilizations of mankind here on Earth, and they were wiped out or left, and then primitive man, starting with rubbing two sticks together to make fire, and then domesticating the horse and work its way back up where we're exploring space again, would have to progress. I guess the only argument that I've got against previous advanced civilizations on the Earth is when Sputnik went into orbit, it was the only thing in orbit. There was no other ancient aircraft still in orbit around the Earth.
So far as we know.
Yeah, well, so far as we know.
Now,
tens of thousands since then.
Let me share with you why I just said that. In 2005, spy satellite images of Antarctica were taken, revealing apparently this anomaly that lies 2 miles beneath the ice. The U.S. Congress attempted to have the Pentagon produce those for Congress, and the Pentagon wouldn't do it.
No kidding.
Yeah. And the Congress attempted to force the Pentagon to release those to the public, and the Pentagon wouldn't do it. They classified them on the basis of it being a national security issue.
Well, I do know that the Pentagon is currently suing Congress for access to satellite capabilities of better than 1.5 meters resolution. Now,
wait a minute. The Pentagon is suing Congress?
Yes, the Pentagon is suing Congress for access to satellite capabilities of better than 1.5 meters. Now, I've done some investigation into this, and it would belie that we have the capability of seeing down to 1.5 meters, and the idea that the Pentagon can't have access to it makes me wonder who does have access to it.
Now, that's interesting. That is very, very curious. But it's also, I want to get back to this national, these satellite photographs, they wouldn't let Congress see them. They wouldn't release them to the public. They're classified due to national security concerns. There's a very interesting bit of information that I tried to take back further than the source of the information. The source of the information is in a book called Atlantis Rising, published by Dell in 1976, written by Brad Steiger, And in this book, he mentions a 1965 paper presented by Canadian geophysicist John M. Delaurier of the Dominion Canada Observatory. Now, this 1965 paper has to do with something very, very strange in the Arctic region. Okay? So it's in the Arctic region. And what he, according to this mention here in Atlantis Rising, Professor Delaurier's paper discussed the existence of a structure so vast that it defied imagination. A quasi-cylindrical loaf of an object measuring 65 miles long, that sounds interesting, by 65 miles thick at a staggering depth of 80 miles. And this structure had been detected by seismic equipment located at ALERT. ALERT is one of the U.S. Canadian distant early warning stations in the Arctic wilderness. And it showed that this object, which straddles the Earth's mantle and crust, was the source of some disturbance, similar to the situation encountered at Lake Vostok 30-odd years later. So this is apparently not their first time at the dance with these things. There's, you know, we're talking about the Arctic, and the fact is there's something very similar. I mean, we're talking about Antarctica and Lake Vostok, and there's something very similar in the Arctic, but deeper.
Well, yeah, the big difference between the Arctic and the Antarctic, for one thing, there's a lot more ice in the Antarctic. For the other, there's a continent in the Antarctic. There isn't in the Arctic. It's all water.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the oceans in the Arctic are about 4,500 meters deep.
So
you've got to go a long way through the water before you can get it.
All right, we have to step away for break. We'll be back, folks, right after this. Don't go away. Let me say to all of you watching on television, some of you were able to see, some of you were not able to see. We've been getting some interference. During the break was a little longer than normal, and during the break I fixed a workaround, so it should be working for you. Dr. Agnew,
yeah.
We've got this thing in the Arctic that is 65 miles long and 65 miles thick. Now, the one, it doesn't tell us how wide it is. The one in the Antarctic, they're telling us is 65 miles long. They don't tell us how thick it is, but they're telling us it's 46 miles wide. So it could be an identical twin of the one in the Arctic. What do you suspect this is?
Well, given that it is putting off some kind of radioactive signature that we're able to pick up through a couple miles of ice, which is traditionally not a very good window for radioactivity, which means it's probably a pretty significant source, I would say that it has its own power supply. And that being said, it's probably a complex of some kind. I don't know that it's still being used, But I do know from at least research that I've done on what's not called a UFO, but a UFO, an undersea object, that large craft have been seen coming up out of the sea for the better part of 500 years. If I was going to visit the Earth or remain on the Earth and stay out of the way of a cantankerous, self-centered human race, I'd stay at the bottom of the sea. It makes up about 4/7 of the Earth, 5/7 of the Earth, and we don't know very much about it. We have our sea lanes, but we don't go anywhere else. And above the Arctic Circle, nobody has ever sailed in some of those regions. They've gone to the North Pole, but as you know, we're heading up an expedition up there next summer to a region that's never been sailed, by humans ever.
Okay, if it's some type of a facility, and if it is extraterrestrial, and I think that's what you're suggesting, is that it may be an extraterrestrial facility, would you suspect that it may still be occupied?
I would suspect that if there is a void there, and it is, not completely bathed in radiation, there most definitely will be life there. That's just the way life is.
Yeah, I understand that, there'll be extremophiles and so forth, but, I mean, what about extraterrestrial? What about the intelligent life that would have built such a facility?
Well, if you're asking me to speculate on whether they would be peaceful or warlike, I would say that they're probably peaceful, because they've certainly witnessed plenty of war on this planet.
No, I'm just simply asking, do you think they're still there occupying it?
I would say they are. And I would say that's probably the reason why this has become a national security issue and not just a paleo-archaeological expedition.
I talked with a scientist today who is going to be on the show later this week. And he's been doing some studies in the Earth's gravitational field. And I'm not going to steal any thunder by telling you folks what it is he's discovered. But I told him about this, and he made a pretty interesting comment. He said, well, I'll tell you something. I have, for a long time, poo-pooed the Zachariah Sitchin story about Nibiru and, that it, every 3,600 years it comes back through here and that it's inhabited. And he said, and I've poo-pooed that idea for several reasons, but one of them is the idea, well, you know, if it goes 3,600 years out, away from the sun, it would be far, far too cold for life as we know it, humanoid life, to exist there. And Sitchin said, of course, that it is humanoid. It's according to Sitchin, the Anunnaki. But this scientist said, on the other hand, if you had some sort of void on the inside of the planet, and they were living inside that void, the heat from the core of the planet could be enough for them to survive on the inside of the planet. Now, he said, based on some of his recent discovery, he's beginning to think that it may actually be possible that this planet that Sitchin calls Nibiru actually exists, and that perhaps they're living on the inside of the planet. If that were the case, And I have talked with other people who have told me, people that had very high security clearances at one time and claim to know this, they've told me that there is underground on Mars an Anunnaki base, and they are all pretty much in stasis. But they are beginning to show signs of reviving. That's what I was told. I can't verify it. All I can tell you is that's what I was told. Okay? If that's the case, are these possible time capsules in which you would have an outpost of Anunnaki in stasis in deep, secure areas awaiting being reawakened at the return of Nibiru?
Well, there are a couple things to think about here. One is that we make an assumption that in order for a planet to be viable, it has to be at the sweet spot, a distance away from the sun where it's not too cold and not too hot. Because we make an assumption that all life has to live on the surface of whatever planet it exists on. We have just recently discovered that one of the moons called Enceladus has liquid water below its crusty surface, and that geysers of this water are from time to time spewing out into space, and that's how we discovered it. So the other idea is that up until recently, we had not discovered very many planets. We discovered quite a few stars, but not very many planets. And so we started looking at those stars more closely, looking at perturbation, how they wiggle when planets go around them. Or if we just happen to get lucky, one of the planets will cross in front of the star, thus diminishing a little bit of its light. And then we can make a guess at what size it is. But we'd only discovered a couple of dozen. That's about it. Then we launched the Kepler mission, and now we're up over 200 planets we've discovered, but we're still making that crazy assumption that planets have to be orbiting around suns. Nibiru is in a different class that we call a rogue planet or a free-floating planet. If life can exist on the insides of worlds, like this other scientist is saying, and like we maintain, that the surface of the world is quite rare to live on, actually, because of solar radiation, not just from our sun, but other suns, and the fact that they have to orbit around suns, if we can live with the idea that life can exist on the insides of these worlds, in cavernous regions with artificial light and artificial vegetable growth media and all that, then, of course, the idea that Nibiru exists makes sense. If we can't live with that, I think, personally, we're going to be very surprised.
I think you're right. I think it will be very surprising for some folks to find out what's really coming, what's really up. All right, we have to step away for a break. And when we come back, we're going to explore a little bit deeper into this Vostok thing, and then we'll open up the telephone lines for you with Dr. Agnew. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and for those of you joining us just now in this second hour, welcome aboard. We're delighted that you are here. During the first hour, we have I've been battling with someone out there who's trying to disrupt our TV signal. Now, we haven't had any problems with the radio signal, but just the TV feed. And I think perhaps that's because of the topic and because they know I will be showing pictures. And maybe there's something they don't want you to see. Anyway, for those who have tried to watch the TV channel, our members who have the access to the TV channel, and you've been trying to watch it, and it comes and goes, and basically it goes. It should be up right about now, and you should be able to see. We're talking with Dr. Brooks Agnew about Lake Vostok, and we're talking about this magnetic anomaly and trying to dive just a little bit deeper into this information. One of the pictures that I have put up, Doctor, and we talked about it, is one that purports to be a close-up of the magnetic anomaly region showing concentric circles with pathways or entrances that go all the way from the outside into the inner circle. There are four of those. And one of the things I also put up on the screen is a picture of a place in Russia where they have exactly the same thing. But it's the picture that I put up, they've done 3D modeling and laid it over the ruins to show you what it would have looked like. And but it looks exactly like the thing in Antarctica.
Well, you know, it's interesting. NASA yesterday released a report that not the mainstream news, but some of the side stream news kind of picked up on, because you know that I'm in the electric car business, and so we're interested in rare earth elements, what are called REE. And you know that China, for the last 10 years, has been building huge stockpile in Mongolia, where they intended on monopolizing the REEs in the world, and because they knew that these were going to be used to make battery storage devices and that they would dominate the market. Well, the interesting thing is that another mother lode was found, a 50-year supply of it, and it was found on Greenland.
Greenland.
Greenland. So this once obscure little no gross national product, almost bankrupt nation, is now going to be a rare earth element powerhouse. And it completely usurps the Chinese monopoly on rare earth elements.
Well, that means Greenland is, of course, then going to be one of the richest nations on the planet.
Per capita, you bet.
Yeah. Okay. What is your best bet? Now, you know, we've made some speculations, but your gut feeling, your best bet about this anomaly in Antarctica, is it naturally occurring? If not, your best bet about who made it?
Wow, that's a tough one. Because there really isn't a lot of information, and what information is out there could be misinformation. I definitely think that it's not naturally occurring. And I would say that my cards are going to be stacked in the direction that it is not terrestrial, that this was built by off-worlders. Whether or not their colony survived, maybe it was pushed far south into the colder climb during a pole shift or during a cataclysm. They couldn't survive on the surface. It got buried under a couple of miles of ice, and they left it. So it's extraterrestrial, and it's not naturally occurring.
Okay. Now, I shared with you about a very, very, very similar object that's in the Arctic. This one is in the Antarctic. So we got one at the North Polar region and one in the South Polar region. Why do you think, if it is extraterrestrial, why would they choose the polar regions, the north and the south?
The only reason that I can think of is that the crust would be thinner there. The magnetic flux of the Earth would be much more concentrated in those areas. And they would be able to harness the Earth's power supply using that magnetic flux. The other reason might be that it's furthest away, or at least most oblique to solar radiation.
Could this be the reason, instead of the one in Antarctica being in a state of decay, and that's why it's begun to be noticed, could it be that it is not in a state of decay, but has for some reason been reactivated? But even in its standby mode, could it be the cause of there being liquid water in Lake Vostok instead of just geothermal vents?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It could be the reason why. When we have reactors, for instance, at Southern California, we have lots of reactors that use seawater to cool them. Some of these are nuclear and some of these are coal-fired. And we warm the oceans several degrees in the bay around those reactors, and thus the ecology, like fish, respond to that warmer water. Fish that would normally live in warmer climes thrive in this area because of the warmer water. It absolutely is raising the temperature of that water.
Pardon me. Now, folks, I want to give you the opportunity to talk with Dr. Agnew about all of this. I've asked all the questions that I can think of at the moment, and I depend upon you to assist me by thinking with me and thinking of questions that we need to ask Dr. Agnew. I've asked as many as I can think of, but I know you've got some. So we want to give you the opportunity to participate in the show, and we do that by asking you to give us a telephone call. The telephone number is 623-444-5889. You can use that number from anywhere on planet Earth, 623-444-5889. If you're making an international call, then the country code is 1. 623-444-5889. If you're in the USA or Canada and you need to call me on the toll-free line, you may do so, and that toll-free number is 888-223-4599. If you are outside of the USA and you are outside of Canada, you can still participate in the show either by calling the main number, or if you don't want to make the international long-distance call, you can use our flash message option. And you do that by going to my website, scroll down, you'll see the picture about tonight's show, and to the right of that picture, you'll see a link that says Flash Message. Please remember that right above that, it says Outside the USA and Canada. All right. Now, the reason we have that for folks outside the USA and Canada is because I don't have a toll-free number for them. All right, let's go to the telephone, and caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yes, good evening, Kevin. It's Terry from Ohio.
Hello, Terry.
Hey, I just got one question for Mr. Agnew or Dr. Agnew. Why would they allow us to, usually you hear, like, stories like, they chase us off the moon or whatever and tell us not to come back, and et cetera, different things like that. Why would you think that they will allow us to poke around there if they are there? I mean, I'm sure they know we're not a threat to them, but, they would, you would think they would just say, go away, and, make it a non-issue. But what do you think about that?
Well, the one thing that I can think of really quickly is that they're not the same group. That the group that's on the moon has a territory, and they have activities that they conduct upon the moon, whether they're surveilling Earth or whether they're just staying in our solar system. And the organization that left that facility underneath the ice in Antarctica, it may be a different group. It may be from another world. So they may be two completely different interests.
Yeah. Back what was that? We had that mission to one of those places after the war with Germany, and that they basically came back with, you know, they expect to be gone for months, and they came back within like a couple of weeks and got chased away, from what I understand.
Yeah, it was called Operation High Jump. It was led by Admiral Richard Byrd, and it was an expedition to the Antarctic.
So you don't think these are the same people, or...
Well, that's interesting, because the so-called Nazi base is actually not very far from this lake. That's one of the things that they are concerned about.
Very interesting. That's all I have. Well, then let somebody else come in and speak with you. Nice speaking with you. Have a good evening.
All right. Thank you for the call, Terry. 623-444-5889. That's the number to call. And if you need to call me on the toll-free line, you may do so. The toll-free line is 888-223-4599. Jeff in Australia sends me a flash message and says, TV not working here, Kevin. Yeah, we know. Thanks, Jeff. Should be working now. Cindy, Tom in Australia, your live feed is not working. Wish I could see the pics. Cindy, you can. It is working. And then one of the pics is up right now. There's always the possibility, of course, that this object, whatever it is not inhabited. And there's always the possibility that it never was, that it may just be a gigantic machine of some kind. Isn't that right, Dr. Agnew?
Yeah, I would say so. It's definitely not a chunk of metal. Believe me, the National Security Administration doesn't have a budget to chase down every single little blip on the radar screen. They would not have gotten involved in some place that's 90 below zero in the wintertime unless there was a serious reason to get involved. Now, of course, one of the things to consider here is this is not a U.S. drilling mission. This has been a Russian drilling mission for over 10 years, and we have never wanted the Russians to discover anything before we discover it. So we are involved, and I wouldn't be the least bit surprised if we don't have a significant American contingent already there working with the Russians. We already know that Dr. Pusick with the Montana University is down there and has already reported to Fox News on it.
Well, in addition, listen to this. The explosive revelation about the anomaly located at the epicenter of recent seismic activity in East Antarctica prompted an immediate denial from the Defense Department and feverish speculation among members of international intelligence and archaeological communities. Now, this is from 2005. What I'm reading is from 2005. Here's a quote. If it's something the U.S. military has constructed down there, then they are violating the International Antarctic Treaty, said an aide to Nicole Fontaine, the European Parliament's French president, who in the past has accused the U.S. of spying on European citizens. Quote, if not, then it's something that is at least 12,000 years old, which is how long ice has covered Antarctica. That would make it the oldest man-made structure on the planet. The Pentagon should heed the calls of Congress and release whatever it's hiding, end quote. At that time, the person speaking, at that time, was an aide to Nicole Fontaine, who was, at that time, the European Parliament's president. So this was, this is not just you and me speculating that there's something big there. This had the intelligence agencies of the planet in a stir. It had the European Parliament in a stir. This is not a joke or a conspiracy theory.
This is a symptom that you might not want to get, you know, too deeply into on this program, but Congress is largely treated like a bunch of temps by the departments. The Defense Department, the Department of Energy, Department of Transportation, they no more listen to Congress than they would listen to the local city council.
Okay, we have a caller on hold. I think the caller hung up, but let's see. Yeah. See, when you call in and I put you on hold, guess what? You need to stay there because you may not be able to get back in for the rest of the show. Maybe you can, maybe you can't. 623-444-5889. 623-444-5889. Or toll-free in the U.S. and Canada, 888-223-4599. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
It's Ryan in Washington.
Yeah, Ryan.
Talking about a new planet discovery, a hidden planet named Tyche. Have you guys heard about that?
No, but I'm not sure what that has to do with the anomaly in the Antarctic.
Well, I was curious if you guys knew anything about that, because like you were saying, if it's out there distant from our sun, then it would be cold, and of course it could... So it doesn't have anything to do with your anomaly, but I just wanted to bring that up to see if you guys knew anything about it.
I don't know anything about it, Ryan. Do you, Dr. Agnew?
Well, if it's part of the Kepler mission, it's hard to keep up because they're discovering so many planets now. Of course, it doesn't do us much good. They're, you know, 25,000 light years away. We need to kind of find something in our neighborhood if we're going to have some place to bail to should things get too hot here.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Okay, this is from Nichelle, I guess it is, N-I-C-H-E-L, and this is from France. Nichelle wants to know, with all the controversy about Zachariah Sitchin and his translations of Sumerian, how could you have any confidence? I think this means in the reality of Nibiru. Okay.
Well, actually, I think the controversy adds more credulity to Zachariah Sitchin's translation. I always have more confidence in something when the church comes out and says, of the devil, and no one should read it.
Well, I take this position. I don't read Sumerian, so I don't know. But I've read his books. I've read Sitchin's books. And his story hangs together, and there seems to be bits and pieces of it corroborated by findings of NASA.
And we do see Sumerian around the planet. We don't just see it in ancient Sumeria. We also find it in Bolivia. Sumerian writing in Bolivia.
Well, and in addition to that, you know, we use Sumerian science every day. The idea that a circle has 360 degrees comes from the Sumerians. Having a day that is divided into 24 equal parts, we call it 24 hours. That's Sumerian. So, you know, and having 12 months in the year, that's Sumerian. And as far as we know, and we don't know really, but as far as we know, the Sumerian culture, the Sumerian civilization, is the oldest known city-dwelling civilization on the planet.
Well, the other thing we know about the Sumerians is that they were already developed when they got started.
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty interesting, too.
They came here advanced.
Yeah. So what do you think about them? Are they off-worlders that landed here?
No question about it. If you look at the ancient Babylonian scrolls and some of the cylindrical seals, you will see that they are explaining a solar system that has 13 planets. We don't have 13 planets in our solar system. They come from a solar system that has 13 planets, and they were, you see them teaching humans about where they came from.
Well, you know, there's another thing, too, and that is that all of the other languages in that area are what we call Semitic. Okay? You know, you have to the north of the Sumerians, you have the Assyrians. Later you have the Chaldeans in the same area. Well, all of those are Semitic languages. They are, how can I say? Look, if you speak German, you can read English and get quite a bit of the understanding, even though it's not German. Same if you speak English, you can look at a German text and pick up some of the meaning of it, because the languages are in the same family. They're related. So a person who reads Hebrew can read Chaldean, some, in that same way. But when you come to Sumerian, Sumerian is not related to any other language that we know of on this planet in history. It's just not related to any other language.
And there are only two other languages that are that way. One is the American Indian language, several dialects of it, and the other is Finnish.
Really? I didn't know
Finnish.
I didn't know the native language of Finland was unrelated to all other languages.
It is.
We have a lot of listeners in Finland, as a matter of fact.
Not derived from other languages.
All right, we have to step away for a break. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Dr. Brooks Agnew. And we're taking a look at Lake Vostok again from a whole different perspective, from the perspective of Dr. Agnew and his training and background in the sorts of sciences that you really would need to take a look at this anomaly at Lake Vostok. Dr. Agnew, one of the, you know, the official story about this is, oh, well, it's just where the Earth's crust is very, very thin, and that's why there's this magnetic anomaly. If that were the case, now, here's the case against that. In 2000, that's when they tried to do the magnetic resonance imaging and found this magnetic anomaly. That's when NASA and JPL packed up all their bags and came home, And they gave a press conference in which Ms. Shingteller, Deborah Shingteller from NASA, made the statement that it was the NSA that pulled the plug on this. That was in 2000. 5 years later, then the rumors were that the NSA literally evacuated the area and made everybody leave. Okay, now, in 2005, 5 years later, this thing's still brewing, and the international community is still very concerned about it, and there have now been some satellite images taken from American spy satellites with their incredible abilities. And the statements that we're hearing out of, for instance, the European Parliament do not acknowledge that this is simply where the Earth's crust is very thin, but they're talking about it as being either something that the U.S. military has built and installed there, or it is some ancient construction that's at least 12,000 years old. They're talking about it in terms of it being an actual constructed object.
Well, they are. They are, as a matter of fact. And Michael Stettinger is one of the researchers who's involved in the mapping endeavor down there, because they're trying to map this thing before they actually go into it, before they actually begin to explore it. The interesting thing is, and this is actually in the Arctic Sun. Read it for yourself. It's on polar.org. It's one of the websites where you can apply for grants, become affiliated, and go down with some of the exploratory crews that do ice core studies. Anyway, this whole study soon became the main source of information on this Lake Vostok magnetic anomaly that Kevin's talking about. They had some flights of a mission they call SOAR, S-O-A-R, Support Office for Aerophysical Research. And it was aimed at conducting magnetic resonance imaging over the area. Now, the magnetometer that they have in this aircraft is pretty sensitive. They fly pretty low, pretty slow, and they gather this information, and they're mapping the crust and the magma beneath the crust. It recorded an increase of 1,000 nanoteslas beyond the 60,000 nanoteslas which were characterized by the Vostok station. This, they've flown over it a few times. All of a sudden, they get this 1,000 nanotesla spike. Scientists had expected to find a magnetic anomaly in the range of 500 to 600 nanoteslas in the areas where this volcanic material could be located, but the ranges encountered, according to Michael, were simply startling. Here's what he said. This anomaly is so large that it cannot be the product of a daily change in the magnetic field. Now, if you want to couple this with the statement that was made from the NATO official, here's what he says. But at the end of Lake Vostok is what's known as a gigantic mascon, a mass concentration of metal, very similar to the mascons they discovered on the moon. A gigantic circular-shaped metallic object deep under the ice at the end of Lake Vostok. The National Security Agency took it away from JPL. It's one of the most sensitive things in the world right now. Anomaly at the end of the lake. It's now classified top secret. This occurred just weeks ago.
Okay, but now that statement from the NATO official, even though it says it occurred just weeks ago, that statement came out in when, 2000?
2003. The SOAR mission is an ongoing mission to actually map the magnetic texture of the crust beneath the ice, and this is where this anomaly came out.
So we have a NATO official making a statement. We have complaints out of the European Parliament in 2005. We have Congress in 2005 attempting to get the Pentagon to release this information and release these photographs from the satellite. The Pentagon basically tells Congress to take a hike.
Now we have Michael Seninger's statement, and this is January 7th this year.
Well, and I found the graph readings for the MRI that showed where the anomaly was located, and to the best of my ability, the way it looks like to me, it's at the north end of the lake, more on the northeast side of the lake. It does not appear to me, based on his graphs, it doesn't appear to me that it's under the water, but it is under the ice. So it's on the shore of this lake, but it's under the ice.
Are they, where is it in relation to where they're drilling, where the Russians are drilling?
Well, see, we don't know where they're drilling. But don't you find this a bit curious? Pardon me. They're going to use a thermal spike, if you will, to melt the last 30 meters of ice to get into that cavity above the lake. On the tip of that thermal spike, there is a camera. Now, I find that to be very curious, because let's say that and Vostok Station is pretty far away from the magnetic anomaly. But let's say that right there at Vostok Station, that's where you drill and that's where you melt through, and you put a camera in. If you're there, you know, you're like 30 miles or so or further from a shoreline. So you put a camera in, and it's suspended in the airspace above the water. What are you going to look at? There's nothing to see except the surface of the water.
You're absolutely right. Even if it was infrared, it would pick up nothing.
Nothing but the surface of the water. So the only reason to have a camera is if you were going to drill close enough to the magnetic anomaly to try and get a look at it. Because, you know, it's setting on the shore. It may have some extension out into the lake. As a matter of fact, from where it appears to be located, it looks like there's some kind of large pipe or extension coming from it into the lake. Maybe not. That may be a land structure or an ice structure.
What would be interesting is if this 45-mile by 65-mile structure is actually lit up like the city of Los Angeles down there.
Yeah, that would be interesting. But, you know, we'll never, ever hear about that. If that's what they find, we'll never hear it.
You don't think they'll publish that? You don't think they'd
reveal that to us? Come on, a government telling the truth to its people? That's fantasy land.
You know, I think you're right, because I remember back in October when the UFOs showed up in broad daylight over New York.
Yeah.
Of all cities, New York. I mean, they're a little gun-shy, wouldn't you think, about unknown objects flying over the city?
Yeah.
And yet, not one single news helicopter, nothing, in the 2 hours that these objects were sitting above downtown New York in broad daylight, nothing flew up there to get a close picture of it. They sat there on the sidewalk and said, gee, isn't that neat? Not Fox News, not Channel 5, not Channel 11. Nobody went up there to get a picture of it. I find that just stunning.
Well, yeah, but it's pretty much in character for those guys.
I mean, if I was a reporter, and I'm making $60,000 a year, believe me, Kevin, I'm going for the Pulitzer Prize. We're going to get in a helicopter. We're going up to the ceiling of 10,500 feet, and I'm getting some close-ups of that thing.
Why do you think they didn't do it?
Well, there's one of two reasons. Either the news organizations are instructed from the people that make the budgets out and make the fuel tickets out for those helicopters to not go up there and investigate because, A, it belongs to us, or B, it doesn't belong to us, and we know who it is, and we don't want to expose it any more closely than that to the American people. Now, the one thing is for sure, it was as visible as it wanted to be.
It was pretty visible, that's for sure. All right, we have
down,
a flash message from...
Times Square.
I'm sorry?
It didn't come down to Times Square.
Uh-huh.
It stayed up there. It stayed as close as it wanted to be, and nothing came up to visit. No jets, no helicopters, no nothing.
All right, we have a flash message from Kevin in Australia. Dr. Brooks Agnew, what are your thoughts that this object may be affecting some of Earth's magnetic field?
Well, something that size, it would be difficult to affect Earth's magnetic field. I think probably Earth's magnetic field is affecting it, though. We do know that the poles are beginning to shift. Now, I'm going to say that with a little tiny S, because 25 miles a year is still pretty slow. But I got to be honest with you, 25 miles a year for the magnetic North Pole to be shifting toward Russia, that's clear across town, people. That's not a few yards or a few inches a year. That's 25 miles a year. That's 250 miles a decade. That's the pole shift that's occurring right before our eyes.
Kevin has a second question for you. Could the drilling release anything into the Earth's system? And I'm assuming he means release something dangerous.
Yes, yes. And that was the original reason why the drilling stopped 9 years ago, because they were afraid that they would release an ancient microbe for which we have no immunity.
Well, I'll tell you something. In their drilling down there at Vostok, they've gotten very, very close up till recently. They've gotten very close to breaking through, but didn't break through. But in their drilling, they have found several ancient, unknown microbes. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We are on Final Approach. We only have a few minutes left in tonight's show. And so, you know, if you plan on calling, you're just about too late. So you got to hurry. 623-444-5889 is the number to call. All right. When we went away for break, Doctor, we were talking about these microbes. They have found some ancient unknown microbes in the ice cores as they've drilled down near to breaking through into the lake. And they have actually taken those and reanimated them, and they've been mystified that something so frozen for so long could come back to life, but they've reanimated them. And I find that to be insane, because they don't know what they are, they don't know what they do. They are very ancient, something not in our ecosystem, and they've brought them back to life. Sooner or later, they will get out.
Well, I was going to have a follow-on to Kevin's question from Australia. I found this very fascinating when I read this, because the Secretariat Treaty, the Antarctic Treaty, is not only trying to protect the environment down there, but also trying to protect our environment. And Kevin brought up a very good point. How in the world are you going to sample this without it getting into our atmosphere? So what they've done is they've filled the hole with kerosene to lubricate the drill, and they're drilling down in the ice, and the hole's filled with kerosene around this hole. Well, you know, those of us that know about hydrocarbons know kerosene grows bacteria like warm butter. So it's going to grow bacteria. But what they plan on doing is piercing into the lake, letting the pressure that's down there force fresh water up into the hole, pushing the kerosene out of the hole in the top. Now, when the water gets close to the top, they'll cap it. They'll let the water in the hole refreeze, and then they'll drill back into it and take that ice and analyze it, and that will be a sample of the lake water that's actually in Lake Vostok.
Yeah, it sounds good, but it won't work. And the reason it won't work is because it's once you pierce through into the cavity, you got a half a mile of airspace before you get down to the water. The pressure in there is not likely to pick up water, make it airborne for a half a mile, and drive it up that hole.
You would definitely have to put the drill pipe all the way down into the water to get it to come up that hole.
Yep, and they say they can't do that because it would contaminate the water. All right, let's take our final call for this evening. Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Good evening, Kevin. It's Jackie from Florida.
Hello, Jackie.
Hi. And I was just rereading James Horak's piece that he had called in with you about the 144 moon shafts.
Yeah.
And he mentioned that there was one down there, and he thought that was where the Russians had put the one they found, that they were moving that. So perhaps that's the anomaly or one of the shafts.
It may be. Do you think it's the same thing up in the Arctic at the north end of the planet? Do you think that also
It could easily be. I mean, you know, I would think they're all around, 144 placed in kind of a grid around the whole planet. I would think the poles would be essential to have them there.
Uh-huh.
But I was just rereading that, and I thought he had mentioned Vostok, and he did. So
yeah, he did.
I call in and kind of add that to the pile.
He and I had a very long discussion about that face-to-face. Very, very interesting stuff.
Well, Tors had written it all out, kind of transcribed it in your site, in your articles.
Mm-hmm.
So anybody can go and read that. It's very interesting.
Well, Jackie, what do you think? I know you're speculating it might be that. Do you think that's what it is?
I kind of think there's a very good possibility that that's what it is. Because they say they're really important. It helps protect us from the asteroids. So if they're kind of trying to get those things to gear up, their engines that run all the time, been running for tens of thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting. Something's down there making a little noise and causing some commotion.
Yes, it is. It certainly is. And I'll tell you this. I don't know if you've been trying to watch the show tonight, but they haven't been doing anything to the radio signal. But
I came in late, but I have been able to watch the last half here.
Well, I can tell you, I've been fighting that ever since we went on the air, trying to get that video stream up and keep it up. And there's nothing different here, okay? It's all happening out there. And okay. I think it's because they didn't want you to see the pictures.
Well, I think that could very easily be.
Yeah. Yeah. Jackie.
It's an interesting picture. It just looks like something laying right under there with a nice big wing on it to me.
Yeah, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Okay, Jackie, thank you for the call. Yeah, very interesting. Are you familiar, Dr. Agnew, with the story about he calls them moon shafts? Are you familiar with that story?
No, I'm not. Are these the shafts that have been drilled in some kind of grid around the Earth?
I don't know if they've been drilled, but they're apparently, as Mr. Horak says, are 144 of them around the Earth, and they are deep into the Earth. One of them was discovered by Antonin Horak during World War II. And he wrote it up, and he drew sketches of it at the time, and he discovered it, a portion of it, in a cave. Most of it was embedded deep into the rock, but he could see a portion of it. And he could hear what sounded like the sounds of machinery coming from it. Faint sounds, but he could hear it. Sounded like machinery. Like something working.
Wow.
So
he speculated that there were 144 of these around the planet, or just from that one?
Well, you would have to read the writings of James Horak. He is the nephew of Antonin Horak, and he's written it up, but he explains in there what it's supposed to be all about. But I'll give you links to that, and very, very interesting stuff. Well, I think looking at this from your perspective, with your background and your education and your training and your expertise, I think we can come away from this at least saying whatever it is does not appear to be naturally occurring, and maybe man-made, but maybe extraterrestrial as well.
Yeah, well, that's what I would say, that it's so old, it's so deep, it's so inaccessible that it's got to be built by off-worlders or an ancient civilization.
All right. Well, if you will, just stay on the line with me. I want to thank you for doing the show with me this evening. Ladies and gentlemen, that's pretty much going to be a wrap for this evening. But it's not a wrap on Lake Vostok. This is fascinating stuff. And it may be that the secret keepers are sitting out there laughing to themselves, saying, boy, did those guys get it wrong. Maybe. Bet we didn't. Maybe we did. Bet you we didn't. I bet we're kind of close to the reality of what it is and what is going on. So we're going to keep our ears to the ground, and we're going to keep watching the news for little tidbits here and there. I've been doing that with Lake Vostok since the year 2000, and I can assure you there will be more as the information begins to dribble out. I will bring it to you. My friends call me Steel Eye, my enemies do too, and you can call me whatever you want to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.